George Pullman was a young entrepreneur in the late 1800s, and he had one goal more than anything in life, which was to make a fortune. And the way he tried to do that initially was everything from digging for gold, which didn't work, moving buildings in his adopted city of Chicago, trying to take an old swamp and make it into a major city. And that didn't work at the time. He tried everything he could do. And finally, he landed on the idea that the major form of travel across this country in that era was by train. You wanted to go anywhere. There were no cars, there were no planes. Essentially, if you wanted to go anywhere across country, you had to go by train. And people were willing to take this train trip across the country that often took 3 days, sitting up in benches that were incredibly uncomfortable. And by the time they got there, it took them a day or two to adjust and get rid of the soreness in their legs and their back. And George Pullman rightfully reasoned, if he could give people a comfortable way to travel across America, he could make the fortune he had been trying to make for years. And so he equipped these old railroad cars with the latest in elegant bedding, in chandeliers, in surroundings that gave people a sense of extraordinary comfort and luxury. And he charged them twice the price of the normal train ticket to ride on his elegant sleeping cars. There was only one thing missing. He had the perfect, what he called, hotel on wheels. What he needed was people to take care of the passengers on that long trip of a day or 2 days or 3 days to get all the way across America. And he looked around at the time and he reasoned that he wanted people who were wonderful servants, who would do anything that a passenger asked of them and who would do it incredibly cheaply so he could continue to make this enormous profit. And he saw the one pool of labor that made sense back then was the millions of freed slaves, newly freed slaves. They had the equivalent of their PhDs in servitude. They would do anything that their white passengers asked. And maybe most importantly, they'd do it all without ever breathing a word of it to anybody off the train.
But put that into a little bit of historical context for us, Larry, because for us over here on this side of the Atlantic, we're not that clued up about the American Civil War and the freeing of the slaves. So just fill us in how it came to be that this pool of black labor became available.
What happened was the Civil War was fought over lots of issues here. It was fought over economics. It was fought over tensions between the two regions of America, the North and the South, that had to do with lots of issues. But one of the major issues, one of the centerpieces of the war, was the question of slavery. The South had slavery, the North didn't. And when the North won the Civil War, one of the earliest things that Abraham Lincoln did as the war was ending was he promulgated something called the Emancipation Proclamation, which essentially announced that all the former slaves of the Southern states were now free. You had all these men and women who had been trained with what amounted to their PhDs in servitude. They had spent their entire lives as shackled slaves brought over from Africa, and they suddenly were free. And for the women, what most of them did was they continued working in the homes, often of their former slave owners, as maids, as domestics. For the men, what that generally meant, there were two kinds of jobs the freed slaves who were men could get. One was going back and working in the fields. The second was taking the most menial jobs in the factories. And the third, it turned out, which was the one job of true opportunity, was going to work for George Pullman on his newly found Pullman Sleeping Car Company. So these slaves went to work to take care of the needs of passengers who were going on these long trips across country. They did everything from acted as their maids, making up their beds every day, to in the middle of the night, if they got up and they were cold, he turned up the heat. If they were warm, he turned down the heat. He ironed their clothes. He did everything that you could imagine being done by a bellboy, by a maid, by a laundress in a hotel, only this happened to be a hotel on wheels.
And when they did everything for their passengers, they arguably also did everything for George Pullman, didn't they? And without union representation.
They did everything for George Pullman because he understood that he had to pay them just below what it took for them to earn a decent living. So he paid them what amounted to slave wages. And he did that because he understood that if he paid them below what it took to support their families, that they would make sure that they took care of every passenger whim on that long trip across country because they depended on those passengers for a tip. They often doubled the salary that George Pullman paid them by earning tips, and the tips were the perfect guarantee when they were out on the road that they were going to do what George Pullman wanted them to do, which was to do anything that their passengers asked of them. The alternatives were to do backbreaking work in the fields as a farm laborer or to do backbreaking work in a factory as a janitor. And if you were faced with those choices, the option of going on these sleeping cars, even though you had to work from morning till night, the fact was you were seeing the country. You were out there exploring America. When you had your days off, you could visit New York and go to a movie or go to a play. You could visit California and go to the beach. This was for men who had basically been raised as slaves in the slaveholding states of the American South. They, for the first time, got to see the North, got to see America, got this sense of freedom. And one of the great metaphors during all the time that slaves were held in captivity in America was the train to freedom. They would see the train going by, and they could only dream about where that was taking people, and their someday being able to jump on a train and escape their lives of poverty and enslavement. And they actually now were working on these trains and were getting to see the country in a way that no other blacks of that era were able to do. So as bad as their job looks when we look at it in today's context, in that world, they were the most elegant, were the best paid, were the most traveled, were the most culturally opportune situation that existed for a black man in America. It was a dream come true for them, and they passed it down from grandfather to father, from father to son, in a way that this job became the most cherished job in African America.
Tell me a little bit more about that period in the end of the 19th century, because Pullman really got going in the 1870s, and it ran through to the First World War. I would say that would be the heyday of that kind of train travel. Tell me about the size of the trains and what one of these sleeping cars would be like and the kind of passengers who were traveling.
Yes, it's something for anybody in your listening audience who's old enough that they might know, because in fact, Britain imported our Pullman sleeping cars to your country. They were elegant enough that today, when you take an overnight trip across Europe, and even more so across America, you're in incredibly cramped quarters with what amounts to fairly pedestrian surroundings. Back then, you had enough room. If you were in the poorest of the Pullman sleeping cars, you had enough room to move around in a real feeling of comfort and space. If you were in their more elegant quarters and were willing to pay a little bit more, you actually had private rooms that were as big as a hotel room. You had chandeliers. You had the restaurants that they had on the trains were comparable to the finest restaurants in New York and Chicago. You had essentially every need taken care of. This was a chance to travel a country with a great sense of mystery and romance. And if on your trip across country, you happened one night as a young man or a young woman to end up in the quarters of somebody who wasn't your spouse, if you ended up having a romantic adventure on your trip across country, there was never a worry that your Pullman porter would ever whisper a word of that, because they lived in what amounted to a separate universe. They were black men living in an extremely segregated world. So in addition to them being the perfect servants, they were the perfect tight-lipped servants, never a worry that they would ever run into you in an embarrassing circumstance off the train, that they would ever breathe a word of that. And as if to sign that compact of privacy and of perfect service, at the end of the trip, you understood this is how many nights you had been on a train, this is how good your service was, and this was a size tip that Emily Post, the ultimate arbiter of American manners, actually had in her books, this is how much you should leave your Pullman porter as a tip. And the whole tradition of tipping in America started in large part by these experiences on the train.
But what would happen, say, if a white lady passenger took a fancy to a black Pullman porter?
For the white lady passenger, she might actually be able to have a romantic encounter with a Pullman porter. For the Pullman porter, even looking the wrong way at a white passenger, if the porter were caught, was guaranteed losing their job. It was a situation where they knew they had a rule book, a very thick rule book that they carried in their pocket, and they knew that violation of any single rule, and the most important rules were not having any romantic relationship with your passengers, but the violation of a rule as simple as improperly making a bed could result in their firing. And George Pullman was not a sentimentalist. He had no compunction at all about firing people for the smallest infraction, and the porters understood that, and they would do anything they could to protect their jobs.
So what kind of a relationship did the porters have with Pullman? Because the way you started telling the story, some people might think that he deliberately employed porters to give them a job because he knew they wouldn't have much work, but he was doing that really because he was just a hard-headed businessman, yeah?
Yes. Your question raises a wonderful issue, which was George Pullman giving blacks an extraordinary opportunity, or was he doing an extraordinary job of exploiting them? And the fact is, he did both. He gave them an opportunity, as I mentioned, to see America, to have the best job that a black man at that time could have. And by the end of the 19th century, the largest single employer of black men in America was George Pullman, and he gave them, as I say, the best jobs. And yet he didn't do it because he wanted to give them an opportunity. He did it because it gave him an opportunity to make money and to give people the ultimate in service. He didn't have to explain to them that having ex-slaves as their servants on this long trip across country was as good as it got. Anybody you talk to from that era who ever rode on a Pullman sleeping car might tell you about the good food. They might tell you about the great accommodations. What they definitely would tell you was the extraordinary service that they got from these Pullman porters. So he was not a sentimentalist. He was not doing this because he wanted to be a benefactor for blacks, and yet he ended up doing that and ended up getting cheap labor and great service, which was what he wanted.
Through the Pullman porters, it seems that we can understand and, well, actually misunderstand, if you like, the great nuances of the complex racial relationships in America, because these Pullman porters, mainly from the South, mainly first-generation ex-slaves, traveled all over America, but depending on which states they were, let alone whether they were north or south of the Mason-Dixon line, they had to recreate their relationship with their white passengers. And some of those nuances were quite strange. You can understand perhaps why northern African Americans living in New York or Chicago may not have suited that job, particularly when they had to say no sir, yes sir, three bags full sir. Really, the Pullman porters were the ultimate house Negroes, weren't they?
They were, and this was the perfect capsule. If you wanted to understand an entire century of race relations in America, the idea of watching these white passengers in very close quarters with these black men traveling across country was the perfect experiment to understand in close quarters what race relations were about. And what race relations were about for a century after slavery looked an awful lot like, as you described it, a plantation setup.
But what was the Mason-Dixon line? Because we just need to explain what that really was.
Sure, the Mason-Dixon line was the line separating the Southern world, the pre-Civil War slave-holding state world, from the world of the North and freedom. Not necessarily good circumstances for blacks, but at least not slavery. So that was the ultimate separating line between the slave states and the non-slave states, between the South and the North.
And where did that Mason-Dixon line actually occur in the geography of the United States?
The slaveholding states like, at its northernmost point, Virginia, was a slaveholding state. The state Next door, Maryland was not a slaveholding state. All the deep South states, states like Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana and Georgia, those were the heart of the Confederacy, the heart of the slaveholding territory. But it did go as far north as Virginia. In some areas, in areas like Missouri and Kansas, leading into the Midwest, you had slaveholding states next to non-slaveholding states, and it was an imaginary line that was also an extraordinary division between one way of life, which was the plantation, slaveholding, depending on black labor way of life, and a way of life in the North where blacks were free.
So at some point in their journey, traveling from, let's say, New York to Florida, the Pullman porter would have to be aware that, hang on, we've just crossed the Mason-Dixon line. I have to behave in a different way. What kind of situations could they find themselves in south of that border?
Great question. When they got off the train, if they had been a black who had grown up in Chicago or Detroit or Boston in a state in the north, and they weren't familiar with what things were like in the old slave states, and they got off a train in Atlanta and they went to a restaurant that was a whites-only restaurant, they could get arrested, and many Pullman porters almost were killed by being on the wrong side of the divisions that continued long after the Civil War in what was known as the Jim Crow era, when there were laws that were passed in the southern states basically saying everything was separated. A drinking fountain, if you wanted to go and get a sip of water, there were coloreds and whites, signs telling you that they were segregated by race. And for a black man to be in anything that was limited to whites, whether it was a restaurant, a theater, a bathroom, was enough to get them arrested by law and was enough, in fact, to get them strung up by a lynch mob. And Pullman porters very quickly had to learn to navigate these treacherous roads of racial segregation in every city they went to. They were the only black men who were going from town to town, and they were the only ones who had to understand that this was a boarding house they could stay in, and going into the one next door that was whites only could get them into deep trouble.
But back on the train, they also had to deal with the passengers, and a lot of the passengers were racists, and they called the porters names.
They did call them names. They called them the N-word, they called them boy, and they called them a word which was the most scathing word of all for a black Pullman porter to be called, and that was called them George. And they used that word George, and this was a word that stuck around for about 75 years, from the earliest days of the Pullman sleeping car until its very later days in the mid-1900s. They called them George because it was an insidious tradition during slavery where slaves were named after their slave masters. And it was presumed that these Pullman porters were George Pullman slaves. And so this was an incredibly demeaning thing for them to be called, and yet it was a tradition that persisted and something they had to accept at risk of, if they complained about it, they not only risked losing their tip, they risked losing their job.
And how did they deal with it? What stories have you been told about how they kind of coped with that?
Their best coping strategy was to try to remember any time they were about to lose their temper and challenge verbally or physically the people who were calling them these slanderous names, what they would think of. And one porter after another told me this. They'd think of their wives, and more importantly, they'd think of their kids, and understood that it was worth eating all of that humiliation because they had a job that let them give their kids opportunities that no other job they could have if they lost this one would ever give them. So these are guys in the early days who understood what humiliation was. They had been slaves, and the idea of having humiliation on the train was a perpetuation of the life they had lived earlier. In the later years, it was tougher to take, but they still had to take it because their jobs were at stake.
Did black people have other jobs on the railways? Were they drivers, firemen, that kind of thing?
They did have other jobs. They were firemen, which a fireman was a job where you essentially loaded coal or wood into the furnace. And they had those jobs, but those jobs were very insecure, and those were a lot harder jobs. They were entirely manual labor. They had jobs as dining car waiters and chefs. But the best job of all, the highest paying job and the highest status job, was absolutely the job of the Pullman porter. The good news was they had a racial monopoly on the Pullman porter's jobs. It was only blacks who held this job. The bad news was to get a promotion to a job like conductor was out of the question. So they had a monopoly on their good job, but they had no chance of rising above it.
Now, this was the day long before the internet and even before the telephone. So you write in your book that the Pullman porters had quite a big impact in the way that information got around in the black community.
They did, in a formal and an informal way. The formal way was they carried black newspapers from cities like Chicago and Pittsburgh and New York. The newspapers telling African Americans in the South, which is where three-quarters of them still lived, about the news of the day, and more importantly, telling them about the greater opportunities for freedom and for economic prosperity in the North. And the only way for those newspapers in those days to get down to little hamlets in the middle of the South where most blacks were living was for the Pullman porters to carry them. They took them to towns that they went to. They threw them off the train in packets when they'd go by a particular station. And these newspapers were often very incendiary, and they had to disguise them. They had to wrap them up in plain black or brown paper so that whites in those towns weren't aware of what they were throwing off the train.
Because they carried a strong political message from the black point of view.
They carried a message, come on north, and that was very threatening as a cheap supply of labor in the South. The people who ran the factories, the people who ran the farms, didn't want blacks in their community hearing about a better way of life up north. So it was a very incendiary message. The Pullman porters carried this message by carrying the newspapers all across the country. In a less formal way, they carried news, they carried word of if there was a great new blues or jazz record that was available when they went to cities like New York and Chicago, they would pick up loads of those records and bring them down south. They'd carry from the South back to the North words of a great singer or words of what was going on in the civil rights movement. They were the couriers for the newspapers, and they were the couriers, more importantly, for the news of what was going on in the various parts of America, taking things from big cities to small towns and from small towns back to big cities. And as you say, in the days before easy telephone communication and long before the internet, the way information got from place to place was with people who traveled from place to place. And in the black world, that was only the Pullman porter.
So they were the disseminators of culture, but not just of black culture, because they picked up cultural tips, if you like, from their passengers. They read the newspapers that those passengers left behind, which perhaps would be very crucial in their later struggles as well. But some of the passengers that they attended to were some of the big name Hollywood stars and sports stars of the days. And the Pullman porter, I suppose, managed to pick up ways of being from them too.
They picked up all kinds of things. They might overhear a couple of their wealthy white financier passengers talking about a stock tip, and they remembered that. As you say, they picked up newspapers and magazines and books that passengers discarded, that they were done with, and they devoured these. These were the kinds of information, the kinds of sources of information that blacks couldn't afford and didn't have access to in small towns around America. They were incredibly brilliant at sucking up all this information. Nobody understood, I think, among their passengers, the extent to which they were looking, they were listening, and they were learning from everything that was going on in the train. They got to know great sports stars, the great black boxing champion Joe Louis traveled on the trains and loved the Pullman porters. The great black baseball player Satchel Paige knew that his best friends in the world when he was traveling America were these Pullman porters. They sucked that up. They knew John Wayne. They knew every great film star who traveled on their trains. All the great musicians were people who traveled on the trains, and Louis Armstrong, the great trumpet player, would have late night jam sessions on the trains where the Pullman porters and the dining car waiters would be with him, and they'd hear these wonderful opportunities to ingest this culture, and they learned it, they passed it on to their kids, and that's why the Pullman porters were not just guys who were content to do the job they did, they were picking up lessons that they learned in life that helped transform the Pullman porters into the progenitors of the black middle class in America.
Yes, this train goes on to glory, this train.
This train.
This train goes on to glory, this train.
This train.
This train don't pull no gamblers, no 40 creepers and midnight ramblers.
Lord, 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 Lord.
When I left Winston-Salem in 1938, I left a city filled with bigotry and discrimination. Lynn Coombs was a brilliant man. Like a lot of other waiters, they'd gone to school at Cornell, other colleges, graduated with degrees. Lynn was a lawyer, but he was my boss on the train on the overnight run from Washington to Pittsburgh. We'd leave Washington at midnight, get in Pittsburgh the next morning. Leave Pittsburgh the next night, back in Washington. And so coming into Washington, I'm the waiter, and Lynn is my boss. He's the waiter in charge. He would serve people, then he'd stand between the table, hold his tray, do a little shuffle, a little dance. So I said to him, I said, Lynn, why do you do that? Why do you do a little shuffle? He said, well, Jimmy, if I do a little shuffle, I'll get a 50-cent tip. I said, Lynn, I could give less than a damn about a 50-cent tip when my integrity is at stake. Let me stand as a man. But too many black men would scratch where they don't itch, shuffle when they don't have to, and then compromise their integrity. By all means, be a man. You might die, but be a man.